Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Hello, everybody. This is Serdar Özcan. Welcome to another episode of Leading Corporate Transformation, the WHU podcast powered by PwC. Today, we are in beautiful Munich and even more beautiful Microsoft headquarters in Germany. And as always, I'm joined by Gori. Gori.
Hi. Hi, Serdar. Hi, everyone. A warm welcome from my end. It's great to be back. And especially today, we have a very interesting guest with us, and I really look forward to our talk. So just quickly, myself, I think most of you know me already, but I'm the transformation consultant in the round, so I will ask a lot of questions around transformation. Transformation is the key, because let me quickly introduce our guest today. It's a great honor to introduce Christian Schätz, who is the COO of Microsoft Germany. Christian, thank you very much for having us today here in Munich at the Microsoft headquarters in Germany.
Thank you both. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yes. And it's great, of course. Speaking with Microsoft, I think you're in a fascinating company. You are one of the most important technology global players in the world. Some would say the most important, but let's talk about this. It would be good to just get a little bit of intro on Microsoft and, of course, on yourself. Christian, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. My name is Christian Schätz. I'm the COO here at Microsoft in Germany. I've been at Microsoft almost 25 years, 2 weeks to go for my 25th anniversary. So a lot of the things we're going to talk about today, I can proudly say I lived through it myself. Maybe a little bit about Microsoft. I think most of it is known. There is hardly a person on the planet that doesn't touch us. And it's a nice bridge to our mission. We are here at Microsoft. Our mission is to empower every person in an organization on the planet to achieve more. And in my role particularly, this also applies to Germany, on how we enable digital transformation for the country, but also how we deal with security, compliance, sustainability, our local regulations, and also how we ensure, resilience, transformation, and also the recently growing topic of sovereignty.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the planet, and if you look at the different epic centers of the world, I think we all would hope that Europe is one of it, but it's getting tougher, and also especially for Germany. If you put the Microsoft Germany, or Microsoft Germany into context of the global set of Microsoft, how important is Microsoft in, or the German Microsoft business for Microsoft overall?
As being the COO in Germany, it's obviously a super important and relevant market. But no, on a more serious statement, Microsoft Germany is really a strategic hub for the company. It empowers and works with the biggest economy in Europe. And it's also a signal from us as a company. We a year ago announced investing $3.2 billion in data center infrastructure. We are investing in training 1.2 million people in Germany on AI literacy, and really getting the company, the country and society ready for this AI transformation ahead of all of us.
Great. So I'm really dying to get to the AI part of our conversation. So give us an overview of AI from the point of view of Microsoft, and then let's dig into the whole AI space.
Yeah, I think the way we look at AI, it's not there to replace human capability, it's there to augment human capability. Mm-hmm. We are very, very clear on that one. That's why we also call the product a co-pilot. It's not an autopilot. Yeah. It's there to help us get work done. It's not necessarily there to replace our work. It can help replacing repetitive work that we all are not super motivated of doing, and we all like to outsource that stuff. But our goal is not to eliminate the human and build a world where machines talk to machines. That's simply not the vision of AI. We think about how we embed it into anything we do as a human being, particularly the information worker. If you touch a CRM system, your email or whatever, you have your helper on the side that gets things done for you that would have taken you personally a much longer time to get there. I give you a practical example. When we prepared for this podcast and you said contextually, this is directionally what we might want to talk about. Historically, I would have had to click through some information sources to make up my structure in my mind of what we're going to talk about today. Nowadays, I just say to Copilot, I'm doing a podcast that's going to last for an hour. This is contextually what we're going to talk about. What would you suggest to cover from a content perspective? And I get a relatively well-developed preparation that I can read through once or twice and just become better equipped to talk to you.
Do you have to fact check?
I did not have to fact check. And the beauty of generative AI, the more you use it, the more it gets to know you. And I also ask it to prepare a little bit about, if I'm asked about myself, what I think we will do later in the conversation. How would you describe me based on my interactions with how you see me interacting with other people? And one of the more interesting prompts when we got into the journey years ago was teams were creating prompts that said, analyze my behavior from my chats, from my emails. What Star Wars character would I be and why? And you get some really nice descriptions. Obviously, there's a fun aspect to it. But you also get a very clear, tailored feedback that actually shows your own behavior and actually helps you to think about the one or the other thing that you do. Maybe I want to change that.
So share, please share. What character was it?
I was characterized as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Oh, cool.
That's not a bad one. That's a good
that's
one.
That's a cool one.
Yeah. We do see that a lot of discussion is going on the impact of AI on business processes, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of your German clients, they are still looking and debating for the efficiency gains that can be achieved and the investment size of it. Can you dig a little bit deeper into the question of how will AI change really the way of how companies are operating?
So, love the question because this is we are ourselves in this transformation. And the way we think about it, 20 years ago, I would have said we eat our own dog food. Mm. Nowadays, we're a bit more sophisticated. So, we are customer zero is how we put it nowadays. So, we start with ourselves, and the frame we have given us is how to become frontier. How do we become a frontier firm using AI, embedding AI into your processes? And there is no plug-and-play recipe out there as the technology is too new, right? So we build a lot on the history where we have learned. So we started with what I call traditional AI, statistic machine learning based models that were built for a specific purpose. We shifted our forecasting to machine learning years ago, for example, and got much better results with much less effort out of it. However, this is a tool that's built for this one single purpose. When we now think about how can Gen AI evolve this experience, there's one thing is to generate your forecast, your view of the business for the future. But then it's also about once the data set is available and once you try to take decisions on the future, on how you go to market, there's also this analytics piece. And historically, you had this data set, you looked at it, you had a bunch of questions, you threw it back at some analytics teams. They worked for 3 days, built a new Excel version of it, and you had a discussion and over iterations you got there. Now, Gen AI is enabling us, what I frequently said to CFOs, imagine a world where you have a natural language conversation with your ERP system. Mm. So think about the richness of information that you have available in your company that is hard to access, and you access it via natural language. And this is what Gen AI is partially already making available today. And this is how we really look at it. And the other thing we look at, technology is not the answer for everything. Mm-hmm. So the way we start our circle is we look at what is it actually that we're trying to achieve, which has typically to do with the customer. Then we map the process end to end. One of our principles is never automate a crap process. So once we have mapped out the process and really understand the process, we look, is there any flaws in it that need to be fixed before we even go to the next stage? Then comes the question, do we apply technology? Yes, no. And if we apply technology, is it more a traditional environment or is it an AI environment that we apply to it? Once we take the decision to apply technology, we also want to measure the outcome. And we have a very simplistic way of looking at this. Applying the technology needs to lead to either more revenue or less cost. Otherwise, it's not really helpful. And that way the circle closes and then we go into the next process. So we approach it very much from a process-driven environment, looking at our data available and making sure we gain efficiencies and benefits from it. I can give you more practical examples. Yeah. So AI is powered by GPUs. GPUs is a very scarce resource today. So we as well had to take the decision, if we enable 100,000 people in our Salesforce with, let's say, Copilot. So you touched on it. Many companies struggle with how do you actually know if it's doing something good or not. Now, our customer zero data shows that if we look at the Salesforce holistically and we benchmark against the starting point of the individual, we see a 6 to 7% uptick in sales cycle shortage. And we also see a 8 to 10% higher revenue they generate as they did before they used Gen AI. Okay. So some tangible data where we can see it. Another way where we, in a more sophisticated way, apply it. Most organizations out there have some sort of customer support or service organizations. Yeah. And they typically, depending on business, spend between 5 and 12% of their revenue on that. We are no different. So what we did is we looked at how can Gen AI make this service more efficient for the customer, get better results to the customer, and also make us more efficient in how we deliver the service. So the way this works today is, let's say we get a problem description in, AI is already on it, listening to the problem or reading the problem, whichever way it comes in. If this is a problem we have never seen before, it automatically routes it to the highest level available engineer, to the highest skilled person to find a solution. Once this solution works, it's embedded in our algorithms. The next time a customer comes in with that problem, it gets forwarded to a regular skilled, let's say, support engineer. And he or she gets the solution that was already developed directly on the screen and can walk the customer through it. Or if we are, let's say, at a 90% or 99% sure this is the solution, an agent will just shoot the solution in almost real time back to the customer. That way, we get a lot more efficient on how we run our processes. And it's also cost-saving-wise significant. But it's the big fear is always that the technology is going to destroy jobs and technology is going to take work away from humans. I think about it the other way around because, first of all, it's not that easy to find people who want to work in that environment. We have a global shortage of talent already, and it's going to worsen in the coming years. So making the existing people more efficient and being able to deal with an increasing demand level with the same amount of resource or with the same amount of people, I don't like the word resource with people, sorry for that, is a very clear case on where we see clear ROI by using the technology.
So these are also the most promising areas for AI, or can you think about next generation AI opening up even more dramatic opportunities?
Oh, there's, I think we are scratching the surface because first of all, we haven't really fully understood everything it can do. And then the speed it evolves, the capabilities it evolves. On a, if you look at it on a 6 month basis, it's, I don't know by what factor the capability is evolving, but it's very hard even working in an environment like here to keep up with it. So I think from an adoption perspective, and this is where the human comes into play, I look at it, I would differentiate between two things. There is what we call the copilot. So this is AI helping you to do your job. And then the next stage is basically an agent who is a virtual team member in your organization. And the definition of an agent is the agent does the job for you. So there's these two aspects of AI, making you more productive, making you faster, better, getting quicker to higher quality results. It's the co-pilot side of the house. And I believe the agentic side is the one where we haven't really scratched the surface of what we can achieve.
Christian, you're the COO of Microsoft Germany. And of course, you also look at costs, right? And you have been the CFO before. We will talk about this later. But if you look at efficiency gains, is there something you can share? I mean, of course, there's a lot of talk how much efficiency this really will allow and how to release it. But from a CEO perspective, I mean, you have grown very like crazy. Were you able to have, let's say, a stable back office structure while growing, or how does it translate?
We have been. I think that's one of the best ways of looking at it. Can I accelerate my top line growth while maintaining my workforce or not growing the workforce at the same level? When I look at my 25 years of history and going a little back into my finance days, in the first 10, 15 years I was with the company, we had pretty much a direct correlation between headcount growth in finance and revenue growth. And then once we started to get really serious, not on AI at that point in time, but really digitizing processes, going much more efficient in the way we do stuff, we were able to actually grow revenue by 292% over the next decade, and headcount in finance grew 6% during the same period.
Okay.
So a lot
now
of
we it, speak.
A lot of it was obviously done through automation and moving into shared service. And another practical example out of shared service. So when we moved into shared service, this journey started in 2004. Mm-hmm. And we started with having local shared service centers. We started off with Warsaw serving Germany in 2004. I was the project lead back then. And the reason we picked Warsaw is we needed a hub in Europe that can handle European language. Mm-hmm. And the reason we needed that, our processes were language constrained. They were not designed to function in a single language. So once the environment was stable from the business process outsourcing, we started to work our way through each process to eliminate the need for local language. And once we reached a tipping point where we were at 80-90% without local language, we could actually get more efficient and ship it to a global center, which is based in Chennai nowadays. And if you asked me before Gen AI what efficiency is still left there, I would say look somewhere else. That would have been my natural reaction. Because the way those centers operate is you have, for each task, you have a so-called desktop procedure that helps a new hire to go through it, to do a specific task, close it, move on to the next one. Now Gen AI came along, and we had Gen AI, an agent, work through the desktop procedures. Once the agent was done, it created a lot of automation, and we eliminated 500,000 plus hours out of the highly optimized child service.
500,000 hours?
On an annual basis.
That's impressive. Yeah. No, yeah. As I said, now we speak. Huh? Here comes the efficiency.
Yeah. So it's really exciting, and I want to stay here for a while. You probably have a very good overview of other regions and other countries outside Germany. How would you describe the AI adoption rate in the corporate Germany vis-a-vis, you know, companies elsewhere?
I think what you find in Germany, I wouldn't describe Germany as a naturally first adopter market. We have seen the same in the transformation to cloud. Germany took a little bit longer for various reasons. I think there is a very, very strong engineering culture in this country. And that engineering culture helped to get the country into the biggest economy in Europe. And it can be an inhibitor at the same time, because the flip side of it is the over-engineering side of the house. So when you look at the evolvement of Gen AI, and you touched before on does the system hallucinate once in a while, in the early stages, yes, nothing functions perfectly. And I see a lot when I talk to customers, they want this 120% solution to start with. Yeah. And if we are not there yet, let's wait until it's available. What I try to explain to our customers is, look, there is not that infliction point in time when it's perfect and when you install it, because over the next 6 months, the world will have evolved. So it's also, I often get the question, can I throw Gen AI on my non-standard data? And I said, yes, you can. The question is, what do you want to get out of it? Is your data in order? The output is always as good as the input you feed a system, right? The other thing I think that is a good thing in Germany, we are a highly regulated labor market. So we are involving workers' councils and so on. And I think the discussion there is often a fear-based discussion, coming back to, is the technology there to replace the human, or is the technology there to augment the human? We are working together with our workers' council to help customers bring their workers' council and have a discussion on how do you use technology for the good and how doesn't it become a threat for the employee, which many workers' councils see out there. And let's be open, any technology can be misused or can be used in a unintended direction. And the more you have an open conversation about it, the better it goes. I, for my personal environment here, my view is a workers' council and a leadership team have a large overlap in what is their mission and why are they here for? Because we are a people-driven company. Our success is dependent on people. So our biggest asset is people as well. So how do we make people more efficient and secure the future on the company is of high interest to the leadership team and is also of high interest to the workers' councils. Now you have some naturally built-in conflict points as well where you're not in the same boat. But in general, if you get to this point in time where you say directionally we want the same, it's a very different discussion. And I see this a lot when I go out and talk to customers in the market. It's often more a fight versus a collaborative approach. Mm. And it's a lot of fear-based, you want to do something to me versus you want to help me discussion.
No, that's true. You know, I always like to say we need to be on the same page when it comes to the workers' council and management and the owners about building better companies with consistent long-term returns, right? That's what it is about. Just maybe switching a little bit the topic, looking at Microsoft, we need to speak about cloud and Azure, right? So, and can you speak a little bit about the importance of the cloudification for your business and a little bit about how you apply it here in Germany? Who are your customers? Is there anybody not your customer?
Well, you will understand that I can't give you specific customer names or examples, but obviously cloud and AI have been the driver for the momentum the company has seen over the last decade, I would say. Yeah. So when you look at the last earnings publicly available, we crossed 281 billion in revenue.
Say it again.
281 billion in revenue.
That's a big number.
Our Azure annual revenue, which we historically didn't really share with the world, now for the first time we did, the platform surpasses 75 billion as of Q4 last year. And the most mind-blowing number for me always remains that outside of all the top line, when we look at the investment speed, alone in the last Q4, we invested $30 billion in CapEx. It's about a CapEx run rate of 1.4 billion a week.
Touché.
And this obviously is also from a transformational point of view, has been a challenge. Now it's not so much anymore, but when we started, let's say, to build data centers, when I joined Microsoft, we had Windows, we had Office, Flight Simulator, a couple of games. The Xbox didn't exist. We were barely starting out with the server business. So it was a different business model we were designed for. Also from our environment perspective. Now, when you enter into cloud and you need to maintain data centers and you need to maintain a supply chain for data centers, that's something we had to build. We had to invent. We didn't have when this journey started out. And this is where transformation comes into play, because the way you did things in the past don't really get you to your future anymore. And we realized we had to change also mentally. And I think Satya put this best when he took over. He told the company, basically, he said, we need to evolve from a group of people who knows everything towards a group of people who wants to learn everything. And we were very much sitting in a what is referred to as the know-it-all culture. So in the old days, we had business reviews with A3 or Legal is the English paper size for it, with 280 data points on there, with an expectation that you can explain every number on there. Not necessarily you took a great business decision on it, but you needed to be able to explain it. So that's not a very productive way of doing things, but we had to evolve from that.
But the cloud business is interesting in the sense that, I mean, you see massive CapEx announcements every day, but at the same time, data centers on the one hand, but at the same time, it's a very, very competitive business, right? So, I mean, the margins are strongly coming down as far as I can follow, right? So you're not alone in this world. You know, you have, you name it, everyone is out there. Where do you see the future of cloud?
I believe, particularly when I look at Germany, we are still not through with the cloud transformation, not even starting with the AI transformation. Germany is still a market that has a lot of on-prem data centers in place. And the way we approach it as a company, we are not focused only on, let's say, cloud infrastructure, data and apps, a world of it. We are really looking at it from an end-to-end view by providing security solutions, by providing hybrid solutions, by providing our modern work solutions. So we really have a portfolio even covering ERP and CRM system where we can go end-to-end, wall-to-wall with any company and enable them, which none of our competitors, frankly, can do. And this is the way it helps us to scale.
So it's end-to-end. Yeah. But nevertheless, if you look at the German economy, if you look at German companies, how good we are we in adoption? So for coming back to this question again, if you say cloudification is still in a beginning stage, you see everybody understood the message and now they are just on the move, or is it still some educational work?
I don't think there is a black and white answer to that. There is a broad adoption happening in the larger enterprise space. Mm-hmm. I would say the larger enterprises have all concluded on a cloud journey. You always have a couple that say, as one of our leaders puts it, I want to hug my servers. But for the majority, it's a multiple shift, right? It's the move from CapEx to OpEx, which is usually a discussion on the CFO side. Mm. I think what really is the one that makes people understand is the availability to scale to your needs that you don't have on your own data centers. The security solutions we can provide is impossible to build yourself. We our systems globally have a trillion signals a day. Your own security system, whatever you use, will never be able to be at the same scale. So from that perspective, I think people understand the benefit. Now, when it comes to how companies are run, there is different buckets, I would say. You have, to the one hand, this best of breed approach where people like to go from each shelf and put a gazillion amount of systems together. It's very hard to maintain. We are more in the, let's say, a best of suite approach. A very simple analogy I would put there is go to a market of your choice, buy 10x, carry 10x in two hands and see how many you get home, or put them in a cage and transport them this way. So that's our picture of how we think about it. And I think the other thing is, in general, you have still not an end-to-end IT business strategy integration in many organizations. Mm-hmm. So how does IT and technology complement your business strategy to achieve your business goals? Or what transformational needs do you have in your business and how technology is going to evolve that is a discussion that's happening in two different rooms of the house, but the two rooms are not super well connected off.
I couldn't agree more. That's what keeps us awake. As of course, consulting. Any good idea? Any magic trick you can share?
There is no magic. I think it starts with, first of all, there needs to be a belief that I do a technical deployment, a transformational project, whatever it is, it needs to be grounded in what is the company trying to achieve. Yeah. And then a lot of it is also how do you, the bigger a company gets, the more internal stakeholders you have, the more conflicting interests you have, and bridging and aligning those conflicting interests takes a while. We think about it in a, historically, when you look at the software business, you were talking to one room of the house, which was the IT department. The way we think about it today, particularly when you think about, let's say, the AI transformation journey, it's much more a business decision maker discussion, like on the example I touched before with the person who owns services and support. Yeah. You can have the same discussion in the marketing department. You can have the same discussion with the finance department. But it really starts at the business decision maker level and then finds its way back to IT. Whilst historically, it started in IT and you tried to influence business decision out of IT.
Yeah. So do they even speak the same language these days then?
Most of them do, I would say, yes.
Most of them do. So one of the things that we often teach in a business school is, you know, if you're in a technology world, then it's not about, you know, competition is not about your company versus another company. It's between ecosystems, right? So, and I want to talk a little bit about so-called partner ecosystem. What do you mean by that? How do you cultivate an ecosystem? And what kind of differentiation does it generate for Microsoft?
Excellent question. I think the reason Microsoft has grown to the size it is today is wouldn't have been possible without our partner ecosystem. If we look at Germany itself, we have 30,000 partners we work with. And it's a complementing effect. For any dollar of revenue we generate, there's $7 generated in the partner ecosystem, according to studies. And when you look, let's say we started out as a company with a bold vision that said a computer in every office, on every desk, in every home. Now, if you think about the population and the size of this country alone, so 70 plus million people, you have thousands of company. We have, the way we think about it, we have top enterprises, medium-sized companies, which is the backbone of the German economy. And then, but you also have small and medium businesses that have between 1 and 5 employees. And if I think about the small, medium business landscape in Germany, it's 3.5 million small and medium businesses. Right. The only way to transact for us is via partners. We would never have the capacity to have
cover them all.
So it's an indirect sales model. And even when we look at the mid-sized companies, that's still 3,500. That's also, we are 3,000 people here. That's also there getting us to our limits. And then obviously you have many companies that are hidden champions that are really market leaders globally in their niche. And they typically have global operations. And that's working with them and working for them is a relatively people-heavy topic that you cannot scale without a great partner ecosystem. Like, you are part of it, Corey, right?
Yeah, of course we are, yeah.
How you build business together.
Yeah. There is this concept of sell with and sell to. Can you explain this to us?
Well, that's really a bit an internal term. So when I think about selling to a company, then it's more like, what do we need to provide the company with for having a super efficient IT environment, for getting the business strategy done, and so on. When I think about sell with a company, it's more like joint ventures. When we go into a joint venture with another corporation that uses our technology to build a solution for the market, it typically runs, let's say, on our scalable backend Azure, but the solution is built by the other company and is also marketed by our company. This is the sell with approach.
Okay, got it.
So you used to be a CFO, now you're a COO. How did you handle the transition?
Oh, I'm in the middle of it. It's a bit more than 6 months today that I'm in the new seat. I haven't been a CFO in all my history at Microsoft. I've run operational roles. I have been the lead of our licensing department for 5 years. So I had a couple of touch points, but I think the key differentiator is really with on the CFO side, you're very financial driven and your focus is very financial. On the COO side, you really look at three dimensions. Obviously, you look at the financial performance together with the CFO, but you also have the topic of customer outcomes or customer satisfaction, whichever way you want to call it. That's a big topic on my job. So how do we build satisfaction, trustworthy relationship and long-term relationship with customers? And also operational excellence, so cloud resiliency, supply chain. It's really the end-to-end dealing with the company that's in this role. That's the challenge and was also the motivation on why I moved ahead.
We touched it in the beginning, but maybe a follow-up question on this one. So you are representing Microsoft in Germany. But of course, as a COO, you need to navigate the balance between the global corporate strategy and the local execution. Can you give us a little bit insight? How does this fit together and how do you navigate through this?
Oh, absolutely. So you touched on it. Microsoft has a what we call a one Microsoft approach that is guided by a global strategy, by a single mission statement that we all live and breathe by. But at the same time, there is some local autonomy needed, particularly for critical markets like Germany. So when I look at the regulatory frameworks, they are probably a bit more complicated than in other markets. On the other hand, when I go to other countries, everybody says it's complicated.
Quelle surprise.
You also have customer expectations that are, you could say they are unique. And you also have a lot of regulation that you need to watch. EU data boundary, the whole discussion around sovereignty, how do we ensure data doesn't leave the country, doesn't go to the US and so on. So translating the global directional strategy into the local needs is a big focus of what my team actually does. I don't do it myself. But.
So the good news is it's possible. Because, you know, we like to say we are a superpower in Europe and especially in Germany when it comes to compliance, right? Regulation, bureaucracy. But you can manage, as you say, the global strategy into the local requirements and move the German entity forward.
Absolutely. And that's part of my role. And I think at a company level, we have reached a good understanding that this is needed. That's not always the case, and this also evolves over time. So many, many years ago, I was sitting in meetings. We did a test run in Idaho, so we are really sure it works for you as well.
Yeah,
I haven't heard comments like this in like 15 or 20 years. So we have really grown up as a company, and we see that being a global company with a strong local footprint and also with a local trust is super important for what I would call our license to operate in the market. Because if you look at the services and the solutions we provide, they are super important for a customer, right? So if they don't work, the customer has a big problem. So our license to operate is really built on trust. And that's why we put this emphasis on local needs, on local markets.
Okay, so what do you find super exciting as a CEO then? And if you were to measure your own success, let's say, how would you measure it?
Ooh, tough questions today.
Very tough questions today.
We are in Microsoft, you know.
I need to see how I answer that. My boss might listen to this.
No, but give you some time.
No, but joking aside, I think it comes back to the three goals I looked at before. It starts, obviously, the role is more internal focused than external focused as a COO. Obviously, I have my external touch points and I care a lot about customer trust and delivering a secure, compliant environment for our customers. I'm also here to make sure that we are organized most efficiently as a company. So a lot of my, let's say, impact is determined by the decisions I influence or some of them I take by myself, depending on how we allocate the available manpower, how we allocate the available dollars to address our go-to-market and what success we're going to get back from it. Now, fiscal year has just started, so far I would say it's going good. I'm no reason to complain at this point in time. However, we will only know by the end of the year.
This good quote I like to make, which says you can be a lifelong employee if you're a lifelong learner. You refer to this continuous learning culture that you have. What's your thoughts on this?
I think it's one of the reasons that kept me for so long at this company. When I joined, I was in my mid-20s, and my mental model back then was I changed employers every 2 years, and let's look how it is here and then move on. However, there was a couple things that were really different. First of all, in the last 25 years, I've rarely felt I'm the smartest person in the room, which puts some sort of pressure on you, and you have this constant this constant nudge that you need to keep up. And it's actually fun to do something new, to learn something new, whilst going to work and do the same thing over and over and over again. I would be in a very different job if that was my desire. And I think it also helps us evolve. And also from a leadership perspective, I strongly believe leaders who are really deeply and genuinely bought into learning do a better job developing their organization and building the next generation of leaders.
Do you also expect, that's why I gave that quote, do you also expect that from people working at Microsoft? Is it something where you say you need to learn, you need to change roles, you need to change or get out of comfort zone to stay with us?
I would say yes. We are not forcing people to change role like on a, let's say, 2, 3, 5 year or any fixed term like that. But it's deeply grounded in our values. And
it's part of your DNA nowadays.
It's part of our DNA nowadays, yeah. This shift to going from know-it-alls to learn-it-alls. And also one of our strong cultural values is the growth mindset culture. Yeah. That anchors around these topics, and there is no way around it.
Growth mindset is, of course, I think most of the listeners might know it, but can you give a little bit of context? What does it mean?
The way we design it for Microsoft means being self-aware, being open to feedback, being encouraged to experiment and learn from mistakes, mm-hmm. So not being centered around let's not look stupid and as a consequence don't evolve, but really be open to try new things, to ever really focus on progress versus perfection. And when we are at our best, the way we put it, we really welcome challenges and we treat mistakes as learning opportunities. And our overall trajectory, where things were, where they are, and where they need to be headed, is kind of built into our natural language and when we talk about how we evolve.
So, and you said that you are with the firm for 25 years. That means you are more or less patient zero. So let's now switch, and that's a perfect segue to your personal career. Let's speak about yourself, Christian, the person behind the responsibility. You actually had a very interesting start into your career. You started in hotel economics in Munich, and then you switched to technology. You switched to Microsoft. So give us a little bit a background. What have you done in the beginning of your career, and why have you switched gears then?
Well, first of all, thanks for asking about my personal journey. I truly started off in a hotel, actually, and I was not a very convinced student, and my academic career didn't look really good when I was 16. So I dropped school and I did an apprenticeship in a hotel. And I worked for a couple of years in the hotel environment. And then I realized, okay, without further education, this might not be the life I envisioned for myself. So I went back to hotel management school and got my bachelor in hotel management. Mm-hmm. From there, moved over to the U.S. and worked for a very large resort in South Florida. I ran labor cost control and payroll there for a couple of years.
So this is how you got into finance?
This is how I found my way into finance and to a little bit the corporation world. And when I came back, I always found Microsoft a fascinating company. I didn't really knew that much about tech. It was I think August 2000, I wasn't too happy with the job I had back then. And I was scrolling, I believe back then it was StepStone. It was really the beginning of the online job market. And there was a job posting on a financial analyst role at Microsoft. And I said, well, what's listed there? I can do it. So I dropped them my CV, and 3 days later I had a contract that was in the middle of the dot-com bubble, and they were desperately looking to fill roles. As I said, I figured, let's have a look at this for 1 or 2 years, and I liked it a lot and I stayed. And when I look back at how I bridge the hotel world to technology, it's really around two things that helped me a lot. The most important thing I learned in the hotel business was it's all about customer experience. Because once you lost the customer, it's very hard to bring him or her back. And the second one is really about operational efficiency, because you're typically understaffed, so you need to be super efficient and get stuff done. And if you don't get it done, there is always a direct consequence, because the customer will feel it. So you get this focus on people, on customer, and that's honestly super relevant in the job I do today as well. And what really then made me stay was this move into super fast-paced moving technology world that was just reinventing itself every other year. Even I'm here 25 years, it feels like I've worked at 25 companies, because we kind of reinvent ourselves every year.
But was it so foreseeable at that time that Microsoft is reinventing itself so much and becoming such a different business today than they were 25 years ago?
It was not foreseeable for me.
Yeah.
It was, however, an environment that I felt very welcomed in, that I felt like I can develop as a person, where I found sponsors and supporters. And I was constantly given more challenge, more responsibility, and that was still one of the best ways to grow. I have to say thank you to some of the people who took chances on me back then. Yeah. And this is how it developed. So it was not really I came in and I had this vision to sit here today and be the COO. However, what helped me is probably 3 or 4 years in the company. I sat down with the CFO back then, my skip level boss, and I said to him, I want your job. What do I need to do?
Bold move.
And he said to me, well, let's have a conversation. He gave me a couple of practical feedbacks on behavioral items I need to work on. I'm not going to repeat them here, but he was spot on. And then he also said, if you want my job, here's a couple experiences that I think you should be going through to qualify. And when I had the conversation with him in 2004, I was thinking about 2010, I'm going to be there. Mm-hmm. And then I learned the painful lesson that when you're in a fast-growing environment that grows 15-20% every year, that the job grows with you. Yeah. So you need to outpace the growth of the role. So it took until 2020 until I finally got that job.
That's an important aspect, yeah.
However, from, let's say, how I took my development decisions, having that North Star was helpful. Yeah. Because in a global company like this, there is always opportunity coming along. And having a North Star where you can basically use as a filter, is this opportunity going to help me getting closer? Is that experience going to help me getting closer to this North Star? Yes, no, was always a good filter for me.
So then let's stick to that. We have a lot of young listeners, and some of them are probably worried to death because of AI. So what would you advise to them? Right. So if they want to be as successful as, you know, you have become throughout your past.
Let me follow up on this one, because you took an MBA during your career. And if you combine this, so the question is, how do you prepare as a young person today for the future?
That is a very difficult question, because my experience is not necessarily the best plan forward, because it is 2 decades old, right? But let me give you a couple nudges that I feel were important for me that helped me personally on my journey. First of all, I did my MBA when I was already working at Microsoft, and I did this in parallel. So I worked full-time at the company and I had a distance learning program. I'm not sure I would choose that again, because there was 2.5 years of not having a private life. Yeah. I would probably nowadays go into one of those exec programs and do this in 9 months full-time or so. But what I would always recommend is having a certain level of practical experience before doing the MBA. Mm. Why am I saying this? the concepts you learn are much easier understood and also much easier used in your work going forward when you have a context of a real experience versus you can learn the theoretical concept, but it's much harder to bring it to reality if you haven't really done your first couple of steps. I'll give you an example. One of the tutor marked assignments they were called, I had to write a there was always the same pattern. You had the theory about a certain topic, and then you had to write a paper about applying that theory to the organization you work in at the moment. And that always forced me to think about the company in very different ways. And I always say, doing the MBA experience helped me understand the company. Mm-hmm. Because I had the concepts now from an academic point of view applied to the things I'm doing here. So that's for the MBA. I would always recommend it. But I would recommend to work a couple of years and then go back rather than do bachelor, master sequentially at university. And then from a future perspective, as I said, we believe in, or also I believe in, AI is there to augment and not to replace. So there is always the saying, someday AI is going to take your job. I would say no, a person that's actually very well skilled on AI is going to take your job if you want to play the fearful corner. So the other thing that I think has been true in the 80s, has been true when I did my early career stages and will be true 20 years from now, is I call it the GSD, get stuff done. So I've seen a lot of brilliant minds that can explain a problem from 50 different angles and analytically brilliant, close their speech and don't have one practical solution on what to do about it. That's not necessarily helpful in any environment. So people who get stuff done will always be valued and it's always going to be seen. And a very good piece of advice I got from one of my former managers, she said to me, in the absence of leadership, lead. So don't wait for someone to give you direction. If you identify a problem, grab it, own it, bring it to solution. That will always be recognized. And I think it was relevant in the 80s and it will be relevant 2015.
So, but let me follow up on this one. Looking at Microsoft and looking at the people that you hire, looking at the people that you promote, do they more have a technical background? Is a more general business background? Can we say something about that?
Absolutely. I think generally we are more looking for mindset than for precise skill in general. Now there is very specific super technical roles where we obviously want the technical expertise. But typically I hire for potential and not necessarily for role, because there's many things I can teach and learn, particularly in a fast-paced, fast-changing environment. But there is certain behavior patterns, then there is soft skills, emotional intelligence. They are much harder to develop when they are not there. So I much more look for how is the cultural fit, how is the person positioning him herself. Obviously, you need a solid foundation to build on. But what that foundation is can be flexible.
Yeah, you know, there's, I remember this quote from Theodore Roosevelt, and he said, the problems differ from generation to generation, but the qualities needed to solve them remain unchanged from world's end to world's end. That's what he said. And it seems like it still is true.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah. So you talked about soft skills. What is like the most important soft skill, if you want to be more precise? If you were to single out one.
If I single out one and I apply this to the organization I'm working in, this is a multidimensional matrix organization. Mm-hmm. So a soft skill you need to have is you need to be able to collaborate cross boundaries and you need to make connections and, let's say, have a mindset of building on each other's work versus an internal competition. And that's easily said, it's not that easily done. So having this ability, a boss of mine once said to me, the further you advance in your career, the more important it is then you can get to results engaging with any type of personality is super important. I've seen a lot of subject matter experts that were absolutely brilliant in their subject matter expertise, and they had a super strong ability to annoy people to a level that they didn't want to work with them. And that gets in the way of getting stuff done. So you need to, with all brilliance you have, if you can't bring the organization, the people with you, it's very hard to get the results.
That's true. I wish we had more time, Gori.
Very true. Final question on your career. If there would be one advice to your younger self, what would it be?
One advice to my younger self. This may sound awkward, but I don't really have that moment. What I would say to my younger self is, and this is what I did for the last 25 and even earlier, is follow your guts. A lot of decisions I took were more from a solid gut feeling versus an analytical review of things. And follow my gut, follow my heart has worked out for me super well. And if I met my younger self, I would probably re-encourage myself to keep doing that.
Well, that's a nice ending. Let's go to the book then.
Yes. Final question, Christian, which is like the classic question we always like to ask. It's about, is there something that is truly inspiring to you? It can be a book, it can be a podcast or a movie. Is there something that you came across and got your attention?
So there is probably two. One is an example from my most recent vacation, where I read a novel that did something that happens to me very, very rarely. Typically, when I'm like 20% into a book, I have two or three scenarios on how it's going to end, and one of them is usually it.
The one that comes, okay.
On this book, I was like 10 pages to the end and I still haven't figured out any of it. And it kept rapidly changing. And the book is called The Enigma of Room 622, written by Joel Dicker, who is a Swiss writer based in Geneva. Uh-huh. The original was released in French, but it's available in German, English, and many languages. And it was hard to put it away. It was really got my mind going and captured me totally.
In a thrilling way, till the end. Okay.
Thrilling
and
till
open,
the end.
Open.
Exactly. And maybe more from a business thing, obviously, I've gone through many, many conferences and I've been handed so many business books, of which I read some and some are sitting in a shelf untouched at home, to be very open. But the one I actually read and actually made a difference was The Infinite Game by Simon Sinek. And that's, it's talking about leading with a long-term mindset. And this is why it's so appealing to me in a fast-paced environment, in particular in a stock-noted company, you're very often over-focused on getting the current quarter over the line. And I've always been a person who does everything I do it for the long run. And I don't believe in quick victories. You can squeeze a result quickly, but building something sustainably that in my definition needs to function when I'm not there is harder done. And I felt I really liked that book, The Infinite Game, because it touches on many aspects on how to do that.
So it's a people's business, huh? It's all about the people, even in an AI world. So time is up, Zerden.
This was great. Thank you.
Christian,
thanks for
it was
having
a
me.
Great, great pleasure. Thanks for having us here in your headquarters in Germany, Munich.
It's should a have nice office. Open day for the public.
Yes.
It's really beautiful here. Everyone
you
should
do,
come
actually,
and see
right?
It.
We sometimes. Do once in a while.
Do
yeah.
Once
yeah.
In a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really nice here. So thanks, Christian. Thanks for having us. Well, thanks to all your listeners. Please stay tuned. There's more to come. Christian, of course, is a benchmark, but we will try to follow up accordingly. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Annika Lux-Rerich and Simon Gerlach.